this week on the Inside Flap.
I mean, I can open my email right now and I will have that message on there. It's every day. And what I always say, and I mean this like sincerely, it's like, just as you are very passionate about your idea, I have ideas about which I'm quite passionate. And, you know, I wasn't just sitting here going like, God, I hope somebody walks up and helps me, gives me an idea for my next book.
And then I talked to my mom today and she's like, oh, what are you guys doing for Valentine's Day tomorrow? And I said, what do you mean? She's like, yeah, tomorrow's Valentine's Day.
What?
And I said, no.
Uh-oh.
I said, this is where I'm going to apologize to my father.
Oh, Tom.
I need to apologize to my dad. And I said, no. Today is Valentine's Day.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the living room, to my right, is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And one English bulldog length away on the couch to my left is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
That's actually really cute right now.
Yeah. Charlie the Bulldog is settled in there
and
nicely. Yes.
I got to say, my view has improved because you both got haircuts.
That's right. We both have haircuts. And I've got my hoodie on.
Your typical hoodie. Andrew's dressed for success today.
Dressed for success. Welcome to the show. Yeah. This is episode 147.
The Inside Flap.
That is wrong. That's not correct. What?
157.
I wear 157. Welcome to 157.
Is this 156 maybe?
No, this is 157.
157.
Right into the microphone there. Okay. 157 of the Inside Flap. Thank you so much for joining. We got a great show for you today. We're joined by number one best-selling author Mark Greene. He's got a new Gray Man novel out. Now it's called Sierra 6. This is the guy who also co-authored 3 Jack Ryan books with Tom Clancy. Talk to him about that, along with his new book and the new Gray Man movie coming out this summer with Ryan Gosling and Chris Evans. So strap in. This guy's got it going on.
I hope you
talk
to him about the hotness quotient there.
I don't believe it came up.
Really?
No. What are we going to... Hey, that Chris Evans, huh?
I mean, those two guys...
Did you make out with him on the set?
I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about general beauty.
Why would it... What? No.
What?
It did not come up.
No?
No. In fact, you'll hear it on the interview. I was tempted to edit this out, but I forgot Ryan Gosling's name, so I was like, "Hey, your new movie with Chris Evans and Ryan," because all I can think of is Ryan Reynolds. The other Ryan.
You know what? I thought it was Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, it's Ryan Gosling, and I couldn't think of him. And he's like,
is he the La La Land? Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, he's
La La
Land.
I like him better than
Ryan
Reynolds personally.
Ryan Reynolds is smarmy. Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Reynolds thinks he's the smartest guy in the room.
He thinks he's the funniest guy in the room. He probably is, but it at times can come across as a little douchey.
Yeah, I agree. Andrew's concerned about the cat.
The cat's over there like chewing on the electrical cord.
Yeah, good for, it'd be like...
it's fine, Andrew.
If you
hear... Don't worry about it.
It'd be like a Christmas vacation with the cat underneath. He's right up next to that electrical outlet and chewing on the... Man, it must taste good. Anyway, we'll have that conversation with Mark Greene for you in just a second, along with our book recommendations. There he goes back to the cord, and of course the audiobook of the big week. But first, I gotta jump on my soapbox for a little bit and do a little complaining. Now I know I'm gonna sound like the grumpy old guy over here. And speaking of grumpy old man, nothing gave me greater pleasure than back in the first part of the school year in my brand new classroom at East High School, where the windows open up, huge windows.
Oh, I remember this.
They open up to the little courtyard area, and kids would, congregate out there when the weather was nice on little picnic tables, and I'd every once in a while, just in the middle of class, I'd walk over to the window.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I would lean my head out, and to the various kids who were sitting out there just kind of, you know, chatting or whatever, they have an off period and they're hanging out, I would lean my head out the window and I would go, "Get off of my lawn!" And these kids would look over to me like, "What?"
I like that.
What?
That's a good shtick.
Yeah, and my my students in my room would slap their knee. So let me play Grumpy Old Man in the Box. Now, Andrew, as you know, I've been spending a lot of time at your favorite store with the musical coming up. And I don't know if it's just...
Home Depot.
Yeah, Home Depot. And we always used to suspect that whenever Andrew just needed a little time away from his three kids and his wife, I got to go to the home. Because every time there would be a stretch there where every time I'd call Andrew, I'm in the depot or I'm on my way to the depot.
So I pulled a fast one at the Home Depot last week.
Oh, you did?
I went in there to buy some glue.
Mm-hmm. What kind of glue? Super glue? What are we talking?
Just some glue, right? Okay. Peter's always working on projects. So anyways. Right.
Gotcha.
So I go over, and they've got like all these put together, like tables and stuff like that, workbenches and tables.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So they got one work table that probably takes like 2 hours to put together. It raises up and down. It's got drawers, right? And I'm thinking, man, Peter's got this huge desk in his bedroom, mm-hmm. and this work table would actually be better because it's got drawers for him to organize his tools and everything.
Yeah.
Now I see them sitting there in the box. And, you know, there's 2 or 3 hours worth of, you know, backbreaking work to put it together.
Yeah. And you're flashing back to Christmas
and then
morning.
Sitting beside it is the one that's already put together.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And it's got the price tag on there, and it's on wheels.
Oh, ooh. That's genius.
Yes.
And what a good idea.
So I just said, well, let me just see if I can. So I roll this huge thing to the cash register.
What a good idea.
There was a second there where she had problems ringing it up, and then she found a way to charge me for it, and then I rolled it on.
Nothing makes me happier than getting one over at
good
Home
for
Depot,
you.
Especially given the story that I'm about to tell that happened to me last week. First of all, I go up to this Home Depot as a one-off Santa Fe, right? As I go up Santa Fe, and I take a right on 6 to head to my school. At East. And it's a really nice location as far as my commute goes. It's right along the way. So I go to this Home Depot. Now, the biggest problem, or the number one problem I have with it, is they don't have... Now, I'm always buying lumber there. 2x4s, 2x6s, what have you, planks. They don't have... You know, they have the special carts with the little... you can stack up the lumber on either side.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's like this whole store has about 3 of them, and every time I go, they're scattered all out the parking lot. So I got to hike a half a mile to the other side of the parking lot to grab one of these carts. They're always hard to find. So I'm in there the other day. I grabbed the cart. And I was like, you know, it's like 5 degrees. It's, you know, 6:15 in the morning. I'm at the Home Depot. And then you got to drag it across the parking lot, which is icy, and there's jagged chunks of ice all over the place. It's hard to push this cart through it. So I get in there, and I needed a tool. I needed a power tool. We're getting an air compressor, a stapler, or a brad nailer.
Okay. Yeah.
To put up some stuff as we're building the globe, the inside of the Globe Theater. So I needed a air compressor, brad nailer. So I go over to the aisle, and of course, all the tools are all locked up, right? So I go up to the cashier. I said, "Hi, I need to get a tool unlocked." And she looks at me. I said, "Yeah, it's over here." And I point in the direction. She's like, "Well, you're going to have to find someone to help you." I'm like, "Okay, I guess you can't help me." So I turn around, and I, you know, do the old thing in the Home Depot, which I hate, where you wander up and down the aisles and you have to look for somebody who's not helping everybody and you got to flag them down. So I flagged down a guy and I said, "Yeah, I need one of these tools." And he's like, "All right, show me what you need." I take him 2 aisles over up the aisle and I point to the nailer that I need. He's like, "Yeah, it's locked up." I'm like, "Yeah, I know it's locked up." He goes, "Well, let me get the key for it." I said, "Great." So he goes away, and I'm waiting. It's a good 5 minutes as he hikes to wherever the key is, gets the key, comes back, unlocks, and it's what it is. It's like a lock that's on the long steel wrapped in plastic cord that goes through the handles of all these tools. So he takes that out, and now all the tools are unlocked, but now each tool has another lock on it.
Wow.
And he's looking at that, and he goes, yeah, I don't have a key for that. I said, yeah, but I'd like to buy this. And he said, well, I have no way to unlock it.
What?
And then, and this is no lie, he says, I have no way to unlock it. He turns around, and he walks off.
Huh.
And I'm thinking, all right, did maybe he was just muttering that to himself, and he's going
to
go.
And he's gone to look for help.
So I stand there like an idiot for like 5 minutes, and I wait, and he doesn't come. I go to the end of the aisle. I look up and down. He's nowhere to be found. So I just shrug it off. I'm like, all right, I guess I'm not getting a nailer. I guess I'm not getting a nailer right now. And then I go to checkout, and I've got all kinds. I've got screws. I've got lumber. I've got various odds and ends. And I go, forget the stapler. That's not going to happen. I go to the line. The woman rings everything up, hits a button, and she says, this is the total. I said, I have, like I say, every single time I go there, I have a tax-exempt phone number for you to put in.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, okay. Then she starts, no, I'm sorry. She did not say okay. She said nothing to me. This is a very important part of the story. She said nothing to me. Not one word to me. Not welcome, not let me help you. Not one word the whole time she was ringing me up. Then I told her I had the tax-exempt ID. She doesn't say anything. She just starts punching stuff up on the screen. And it's obvious she has no idea how to enter the tax-exempt number. But she's punching it and punching and punching all the different options. And I see words flashing up on the screen. She's going through all the menus to find. And I see contractor, work order, all this stuff. She goes through like each menu 3 times. And then she doesn't look at me and say, hold on 1 second. Again, and I don't know what it is about the store, she turns around and walks away. And now I'm just standing there now with my whole order at the checkout line. And she has now walked away. So now I have to wait for her to come back.
Which Home Depot is this?
The one off of Santa Fe.
Okay.
On my way that you were busy sneezing and walking across.
I'm sorry, so, I did have an issue.
So let's say,
not our Home Depot here in Littleton. Okay. The Denver Home Depot.
Well, and that's a pretty still a major Home Depot.
It's a massive. Like, yeah. It's a huge hub.
Oh, I know that one. Yeah.
Yeah. So she comes back alone, and again she goes through all the menus. Oh, boom, 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 boom. Again, not one word to me. Still doesn't get it. Picks up the phone, tries to dial an extension. Nobody answers. Hangs it up. Goes back. Walks away again. Finally, she gets another woman to come over. The other woman shows her how to do it. The woman does it. She says, what's the phone number? I give her the phone number. Rings me up. I pay. And that's that. She never did not say, and this is my problem. This is my point. The point is, whatever happened to a little... Now, Andrew, you and I used to work at a seafood market where we had a deal with the... I worked many jobs with customer service. There is no customer service. There was no, from either her or the guy who had to unlock my tools, who never did, not an I'm sorry, not an hey, I know you just wasted 10 minutes of your life here. Have a wonderful day. Grab a free Coke on your way out. Not just a simple I'm sorry. Nothing. Nothing.
So you didn't hit that bell for good customer service on your way out?
I got nothing. No.
Well, and you know, and this is just a symptom of the, it's another thing of COVID, right? I mean, the store obviously.
Yeah, they're wearing masks, so they feel like they don't have to say anything.
Well, no, I don't think it's the mask. It's just simply they don't have the people there. A lot of people probably left there to get better jobs.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's probably it. And, yeah,
they haven't been trained properly.
They have not been trained properly.
And this sounds like a Sunday morning. Like, were you there early in the morning?
On a work day.
Okay.
Yeah, very early in the morning, like 6:15 in the morning.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe 6:45.
So that's part of it too. Is I mean, you're there first thing in the morning, and
but all the contractors are there first thing. In the morning.
Yeah, it's hopping. It's hopping.
My guys always go there first thing in the morning.
Yeah. But nothing. And it's so frustrating. I remember, Andrew, when we used to work at that seafood market, the one woman would come in and she would want these little tiny perch filleted. We wouldn't.
Really?
To 5 pounds of these little tiny fish and you'd have to fillet them.
Why did she want them filleted?
I have no idea.
Well, let's see.
You can fillet
the fish.
Such a pain.
You can butterfly the fish. You know?
Yeah.
You can do the fish bone out.
Now, and I was terrible at it, too. I would hack away.
Oh, I cannot imagine you'd be good.
No,
good at
I was awful at it. No. And I'd chuck these hunks, these fillets look terrible. I'd throw them in a bag, put a bunch of ice on it so you couldn't see them, and I'd send her
hopefully
on the way.
Hopefully she breaded them.
But, yeah, but did I ever say, I would always, you know, always nice to the customer. The customer is always right. Thank God that's not true in my classroom.
Wait, though, you know what part of it is, too? I think when you work for a big monster chain, you're less inclined to put out the big thing. You're not working for an owner.
True. Yeah, you don't know the owner.
Like when you guys worked at the seafood market, you probably knew who the owner was.
Sure, John Harris's father.
Oh, was it really?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Huh. So there you go. But, yeah.
But I think most stores and most business, you know, you should be customer centric.
Absolutely.
Right? And
yeah.
And that's just good business is you take care of the customer. And I, you know, I just think it's a sign of the times with Home Depot and
I think so
like,
too.
And COVID. Yeah. But we've just seen this like business after business where they have signs up. Apologize.
Yeah.
You know, Home Depot, a big store like Home Depot is not going to put a sign in the store that says, you know, but they probably have a huge old we're hiring sign out front.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's frustrating.
I don't know. It's very, very frustrating. And just a simple, I'm sorry.
Didn't go to Lowe's.
That's all, right. Laura, how, and Andrew, remember, we used to also work at a bakery together where they would make the pornographic cakes.
Ugh, well, so I mean, gross. You know, it's all about customer
that
service.
That is so gross.
Oh, yeah, they were, too.
Ugh.
On that note, Laura... How are you doing this week?
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Happy
speaking of which,
guys.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's
right.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah. So
as we record this, it is Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had a moment today, Andrew, where I thought that Dave might have forgotten that it was Valentine's Day.
Never.
So he came home. Let's see. What time did you get home? Around 4. I need to take Sylvie somewhere.
Right.
And it was a quick... Hey, how you doing? Okay, Andrew's coming over. I said, okay, I'll have dinner ready at 7. Mm-hmm. We'll be ready to go. No problem. That was it. And I thought,
Aha. You
did
thought
he remember?
Forgotten. Right. No.
So then we're out of salt because I dropped and spilled like an enormous container of salt.
I hope you threw some of that over your shoulder.
Well, it was already over my shoulders all over the floor, as you know.
Yeah.
So... I needed salt, so I said, Dave, can you get me some salt? And I thought, well, I'm sending him into the store. Surely he'll remember.
He's
bound to notice that it's Valentine's Day when he goes in the store. But you had already done it. Yeah,
yes,
I didn't know that, so
yes,
that was really nice. Mm-hmm. And then I talked to my mom today, and she's like, oh, what are you guys doing for Valentine's Day tomorrow? And I said, what do you mean? She's like, yeah, tomorrow's Valentine's Day.
What?
And I said, no.
Uh-oh.
I said, and this is where I'm going to apologize to my father.
Oh, Tom.
I need to apologize to my dad. And I said, no. Today is Valentine's Day.
Oh, Tom.
Yes.
No. So did he forget to get her anything and then tell her that Valentine's Day was tomorrow?
I don't think he was that nefarious, but he definitely didn't get her anything because she joked at me. She's like, oh, I can tell because of all the Valentine's Day gifts that are here.
Swamped in chocolate.
And the fact that Valentine's Day is on a Monday.
It's a little tough.
Right?
It is tough.
No, you had all weekend to plan for it.
Exactly,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I bought my Valentine's gifts to my Valentine, Sylvia and Dave.
When
I bought those on Friday.
When I woke up this morning, there was a lovely...
I'm sorry.
Treats on
Monday
the
is actually a better day to have it on than if you were going to say a Tuesday, Wednesday, or a Thursday.
Good point.
Because you have the weekend to prepare.
That's not the way that I think. So,
but now this is what I heard, Andrew. I heard.
Yeah.
But Dave Thomas was telling me he was talking to you, and you had Peter and Dashiell in your car, and your own speaker, and you were driving on the way to get Katie some flowers.
We'll get to that.
And no, we're going to get to it right now. And this is what I heard is that Andrew, as he was explaining to Dave where they were going, yelling to the kids in the backseat, Valentine's Day is a fake holiday. It's fake. Kids, it's a fake holiday. Is there any truth to this rumor that you were telling your kids that it was a fake holiday?
No, I don't know that I said it was a fake holiday.
Mm.
Maybe I said it was like a manufactured holiday or something like that. I don't know that I used the word fake, but yes, it is not my favorite holiday. Because, you know, of course, I express the love for my loved ones.
Yes. Here's a question.
Every single day.
165
sure.
days a
sure.
year.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. But Andrew, what did you get for Katie? Do you get like flowers and chocolate? Is that what she expects?
So I got her 2 dozen long stemmed red roses in a vase with things. Mm-hmm. I get Mary Kate a little flower arrangement because I want to set the bar pretty high for when she starts dating some schmuck.
Oh, you think, you just yelled at your two boys.
Right. The boys got the, it's a manufactured holiday. Wait,
and now you're setting the girl up for failure here.
So what boys, let's see.
That's a great point.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Then I got Katie a gift certificate to her favorite spa.
Oh, that's nice.
And then tomorrow night we're going out to an Italian restaurant.
Oh, that sounds great.
Because Valentine's Day is such a zoo, right?
Yeah.
We don't ever like.
It's
go
a
to
Monday
dinner.
Too. I feel like it's not a good restaurant day.
So I think, I think that was that. Now, a difference is this year I actually got a box of chocolates.
Oh.
And a card from Katie for Valentine's Day.
That's nice. She doesn't usually get you something?
Maybe a card or something like that, but,
some cash.
And she baked a really nice cake tonight.
Oh,
too.
That's nice.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, I made my usual Monday night meal. Nope.
Roasted potatoes.
That's all I ever do. Roasted vegetables. That's fine. It's fine.
No, it's delicious. It's fine. It's delicious.
Yeah, but you guys remember the, did you have Valentine grams or whatever when you were in school?
No.
You didn't?
Not that I participated.
We had candy grams. Do you remember candy grams?
No, I don't think we had that one. Oh. I certainly had it today with kids kicking in the door every 5 minutes, blaring. And I guess you could request a song to be played. So if you bought a candy gram, you'd request a song for them to play. So they were walking around today with a Bluetooth speaker blasting music. And they come into the classroom. What not? You just walked in blasting music like right in the middle of class.
Oh.
And finally, my last two classes, the kids were so off the charts today with candy and with their talking of their love lives. I had kids crying. I had kids in, I'm not even lying. Crying. Several kids walking out. Kids were all sugared up. My last two classes, I gave them something that they could, quote, brainstorm about. And said, I'll be at my desk if you need me. But I was done.
Wow.
I was
done. So it creates drama.
Done. It's way too much drama. It was it was absolutely ridiculous.
There's got to be a better way to fundraise for the
student
council.
I picked up so many candy wrappers at the end of the day today. Huh. It's out of control. And this is high school.
Yeah, because I still remember, and it was a little traumatic because I never got any. And if my memory serves me, my friend Renata and I, who I've mentioned on the show before, who we saw at New York City.
Shout out to Renata.
We would get each other. At one point, we're just like, okay, you get me a candy gram, and I'm going to get you a candy gram. So we wouldn't just be the only two females in the classroom that didn't have crap delivered to us during math class or something like that. Because I remember feeling embarrassed about it.
Andrew and I bought ourselves candy grams, but then we got beat up at the boys' locker room afterwards.
Is it true?
That never happened.
Yeah. Oh, come on. Well, see, the thing about the candy gram is no one has to know who it's from. And if I remember right, I think we both signed it because we're dorks.
Pretty smart.
We signed it like from your secret admirer. Something really embarrassing. Boy. I know. I could write a really sad, maybe a non-rom-com.
Non-rom-com.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Andrew.
So yesterday was the Super Bowl.
That's right. Yeah. Forgot all about it.
And I had no desire to really watch the game.
Mm-hmm.
There was only two things that we were interested in.
The hot quarterback from the Bengals.
No.
Joe Burrow.
Care about the quarterback, for God's sake.
What?
And then, so we cared about the halftime show, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was aimed at us.
Well,
right?
That's right.
It was aimed at Gen X.
It was Gen X. Yep.
So, cared about the halftime show. And then, of course, was in this pool, one of these pools where you pick squares.
Yeah, the square pool. How many squares did you buy? You bought like two squares.
I bought two squares.
And speaking of Dave Thomas, his pool.
And so, I did everything at random. I flipped a coin to decide which squares to take, so it's completely random. And then typically the numbers are also assigned randomly.
Yeah, and right? They are assigned randomly. So it's completely, random.
And the one square I got, I'm like, these are really weird numbers. Like, it's really hard to think of how you would come up with like a 5 and an 8 on a score.
Right.
right? I mean, they have to get like...
Five and twos are the worst numbers.
Yeah. So I had a five and an eight. And then the other one I had...
My eyes are rolling back. I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
So I had zero.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
It doesn't
the other one I had zeros and threes, good scores. And so, you know, so basically I did pretty well. I got some scores. I won two quarters, including the final score. And then I'm waiting to see what the total is that I've won off this pool.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turns out I won nearly $3,300.
You know, I am so tired of Andrew getting on the podcast and telling us about his winnings. Yeah. How tiresome is this? Just once I'd like to have him come in here and tell me about the lottery tickets he bought and didn't hit on.
Yeah, we don't talk about it. We don't talk about the losers. But so
that's true.
So of course, so Katie had no idea, and then she found out, you know, and then she's like, oh, here's my Venmo account.
Yeah, well, here's the funny thing, because Andrew doesn't have a Venmo,
I paid
Dave Thomas through my Venmo. Andrew gave me a check, and I Venmoed Dave.
Oh, you're right. You were the middleman
in
that.
I was a middleman, and then Andrew, I'm talking to him on the phone right after the Super Bowl. He's telling me he won, and then he says to me, yeah, I guess you'll have to Venmo, Dave will Venmo you the money, and then you can give me a check, and then... You must have been on speaker or something, because I heard it clear as day, Katie right there, here's my Venmo! He can send it right to me! Just have him send it to me! I'm writing it down right now! I was like, what? Yeah. Where did Katie come from?
Yeah.
So Andrew's not seeing a dime of that money.
No,
so.
You're not, Andrew. Yeah. No.
Unfortunately, that was the mistake you made by having her on speaker
Just
and talking about it.
Get yourself a Venmo, man.
It is what it is, right? And so, the thing, and so... We actually have a chef coming to cook dinner for us a week from tonight.
Oh, boy. Yeah, let me get my... where's my music here? Yeah. Okay.
So it's Katie's birthday, and so it's like a five-course meal.
Hey, Dave, my birthday's Friday.
Oh, great.
And so so Dave and Laura are going to come over. So this time, Monday night, we'll have just finished a lovely five-course meal.
I'm excited about that.
With our chef Eric Volo, I think his last name is.
Mm.
And... you know, and we every once in a while we have him over. Now, fortunately, I've only gotten like a third of my winnings, because it turns out that like one guy had one pile of money, another schmuck has got a second pile of money.
Sure.
And so, but fortunately, the money that I've actually gotten is enough to pay for, you know, dinner Monday night.
Oh, nice.
Which is not okay. You know, which is not a small amount.
How many people are coming?
I think it's eight of us all together.
Okay, that's nice.
Yep.
All right.
Do we know the other people?
Well, it's Christine, our like friend.
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. I know her.
Sometimes
Christine,
babysitter.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
So all right.
It's her times well, two.
I didn't know how that
four.
Equals eight.
Well, there's three kids.
Three, four. Oh, gotcha.
Oh, the
there's
kids
five
are going to be there.
Yeah, two of you and Christine.
I gotcha.
All right.
I gotcha.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it. And if you're out there right now, hopefully you're looking forward to our interview with Mark Greene. His new book is called Sierra 6. This is the 11th book in the Gray Man series, and the one that goes back in time to reveal the backstory behind Court Gentry and how we got to start as a lowly sixth man on a CIA action team. And that's where the title comes from, because he's known as Sierra 6. The book is also told in two different timelines, so it takes place in the present as well, where it is 12 years later. Court is just a vet at the espionage action game, working as a CIA contractor, and he is dealing with a terrorist that he thought was long dead, but is now back in the terrorism game in Mumbai. This is exciting stuff. Fans of Tom Clancy and military thrillers will love this one. Had a great chat with Mark, and here that conversation is for you right now. Dogs as well, and I mean, there's just nothing you can do. They have no idea. Like, you're trying to get a little business done, and no,
it's always a disaster. But this, the front windows of the house are right here. I told my wife, I was like, if somebody walks a dog by here, it is literally, I'm gonna have to leave the room. I would just have to leave the probably just shut my computer and forget the whole
thing. Yeah, it's the same thing. Like, I mean, somebody could be walking their dog on the other side of the street. And we got the one mutt who goes crazy, and then the bulldog just follows him around.
Yeah, that's what there's always one instigator, and everybody else is just trying to one up the other dog.
Exactly. And our dog last night, I had literally I don't know if I got any sleep last night because the one dog kept barking every hour. And I go in, I think we have like mice behind our fridge because he was at the fridge barking. It I don't know why we. So what kind of, where are you in the Midwest? Where are you at?
I'm in Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I guess you guys aren't prepared for ice storms.
The city is in a hardwood forest, and all of our power lines are above ground. So it takes nothing to. They said there are 140,000 homes without power or something, and they've gotten it down to like 60,000. I feel like we're probably not not next to a hospital or anything that gets prioritized. So we'll get it when we get it. I'm glad I bought the generator last year. I said if I buy a generator and spend all that money, I will never have a power outage. So it's actually good insurance. But this is the second time we've had to use it in a year. So
wow, yeah, that is quite fortuitous. Usually you're like the guy who buys the snowblower and then it never snows.
Yeah, never uses it. Yeah, yeah. The kids, we had snow last year for like the first time in forever, like accumulation, and the kids were like, we want sleds for next year. So I have all these stupid sleds. And, you know, even during the ice, storm, it didn't really coat the streets. It was just damaging trees. So,
damn it.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Mark, thanks so much. I'm Dave. Really appreciate you taking a little time to talk to me today. Sure. Loved your book, Sierra 6. But before we talk about that, how excited are you? Good God, a movie with Chris Evans and
Gosling.
Ryan Gosling. How excited are you about this? I mean, man.
Yeah, it remains surreal. It's been surreal the whole process. I originally sold an option to Hollywood back in 2009 for The Gray Man, and it's bounced around and it's gotten close before.
Right.
And I always knew it was a million to one shot, even when I, you know, had it optioned. And every time we'd get close and it would go away again, I would just sort of get a little bit more walls put up. And I guess in 2020, they were saying that Ryan Gosling was interested. And I was like, yeah, okay. That's a new actor's name. It's like the 13th actor that you told me is interested.
Right.
And then a few months later, they're like, yeah, we're starting shooting. And it's been incredible. I'm sure, you know, I told my wife, it's like, we'll be flipping channels and it's going to be on Netflix. And we're gonna be like, oh, wow. it remains surreal. It probably will always be a little surreal.
That's so cool. Did you get to visit the set or anything? Or maybe
no,
with COVID?
No, I mean, with COVID, it was tough. And the other thing that's tough is I write two books a year every year. And for some dumb reason, I make the books like 150, 60,000 words. So, you know, that's a self-inflicted wound. But I talked to the directors. They sent me the shooting script right as it started. And I'm really happy with the script and the cast, of course. So I'm very hopeful. It's going to be terrific.
Yeah, hard not to be happy with the cast.
Yeah,
man. When is that coming out? It's coming out in March.
The summer. I'm told the summer, but I don't know exactly a date yet.
Well, that's when he saved the good movies for the summer. So that's. But yeah, so let's talk about your book, Sierra 6, the new Gray Man book, the book that gives us the backstory on Court Gentry.
Right.
Very exciting. And it's also the book that finally answers the question that I needed answering, what it means to spin the ball. Mark, what was it that inspired you to write this latest chapter in the Gray Man series?
Well, I had an idea for a long time. I'm 11 books in. Sierra 6 is the 11th Gray Man novel. Yeah. And I've always alluded to my hero, Court Gentry, his past, and I've never really gone back there. I've done a few little flashback things, but as far as like having a plot that takes place in the past, I wanted to do it. But then the danger of that is, well, everybody knows how it ends because they know that in the present, your hero is still alive.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
How do you make that, you know, fascinating to people? And so I came up with an idea of two timelines 12 years apart. So you see the hero, Court Gentry, he's 25 years old, young CIA officer, folded into a paramilitary unit to go to Pakistan to try and stop a terrorist who plans on detonating radioactive dispersal devices or dirty bombs against coalition forces. And then you also see him in the present where he's an older, wiser, kind of more world-weary guy. Right. He's working as a freelance intelligence asset for India. And he comes across a ghost from that previous mission, which actually was, you know, was like one of the toughest moments of his life. And once he realizes there's a guy still alive that they didn't think was alive, it sets him on a whole new thing. So it's two different times. It's basically two 80,000 word books interwoven that relate to each other. And, yeah. You know, it's got two ticking clocks, sets of twists and turns. So it's a pretty wild ride, I think.
It's great the way you did it too, because a lot of times you'll read a book with two timelines and you're just like, you're waiting for one to get over so you can get back. But this one has two, it's like you said, it literally is like two different novels. Each one is gripping and as intense, and the stakes are high on each one. Do you write them separately or do you write them at the same time?
I tried everything. this time last year, I was throwing the kitchen sink at this book because of that reason. Like, my big fear was, you know, I'm a reader before I'm a writer, and we've all read books where you're in one plot line and you're really into it, and then you turn to the next chapter and you're like, oh, we're back here. I just have to muddle through this. And so the entire time I was writing this book, I was going like, all right, whatever just happened in the past, the thing in the present has to be just as interesting. They have to be related in a certain way, because I think that really propels the story. But it was tough, and it was something I thought about, you know, probably early last summer. I was like, oh my gosh, my, you know, one story doesn't have the impact of the other story. I've got to go beef that one up. So I didn't write them one at a time. I wrote them together. I tried writing them one at a time for a while, and then just got kind of confused. So.
That's true. You do have to keep track of everything. Speaking of keeping track of everything, when you're writing the backstory, the stuff in the past, did you have to like look up and remember like all the different idiosyncrasies of the different people? Because now your readers are infinitely, probably more aware of your characters than you are. Did you have to do any research on your own characters?
Absolutely, I did. And just for the reason you just said, it's like people start to know your characters better than you do, because I write one Gray Man book a year and then one other thing a year. Yeah. So, you know, I spend a lot of time with it, but I also spend a lot of time working on other characters or other things. So I had to go back and see like, what did he say the names of those guys on his paramilitary team were, and, you know, work that in. And, you know, I've made mistakes in the history of the story before. I think in the first book I said that Court was from near Jacksonville. And then in another book, I misremembered that and said he was from near Tallahassee. So, I fixed it in another book where I found the little town exactly between the two cities and went that way. And so that's where he's from, you know, like once I named it. But yeah, you have to be careful about stuff with that. It's called, Springs. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head. It's in a couple of books. I'll have to refer back to my book.
That's why you got up. My wife's from Jacksonville, and we both went to Florida State and Tallahassee.
Okay.
We've driven. Yeah, we made that drive back and forth many times.
I love Northern Florida, and I think it has a cool identity. You know, it's the South, but it's not the South. I don't know. I made my hero born and raised there because I thought it was, you know, it's not stereotypical, you know, that you see. And I just thought that it was an interesting part of the country.
Yeah, it's really not something you see a lot about. And Jacksonville, unfortunately, now is just, I mean, with the Jaguars, you don't hear a lot of good things coming out of where are you from, Mark?
Memphis, Tennessee.
Are you from Memphis?
Born and raised. I lived in Miami for a few years, but the rest of the time I've been here in Memphis.
Nice. Awesome. You go down to Graceland a lot? You go check out Graceland?
Nobody who's from Memphis goes to Graceland a lot. And although I used to work in international business, and I'd have a customer come in from Japan or Brazil or the UK, and they'd always want to go to Graceland. So the hierarchy of how important the customer was determined whether I would go on the tour with them or if I would just drop them off and pick them up later. But yeah, I've been, and I'm actually a big Elvis fan, but I haven't been inside Graceland in 20 something years. There's a concert venue attached to Graceland now, and I go see shows there.
Very nice. Now, it sounds like you really made it hard on yourself with this book. Did you enjoy writing the backstory? Did you was that a lot of fun for you?
It was a lot of fun because it's also daunting because you're like, I have a character in the series named Zach Hightower who has been in several of the books, but we're going back to when Court and Zach actually meet. And Zach is the head of this paramilitary unit for the CIA. Special Activities Division. And I usually make Zach really funny. He's a wisecracking, sarcastic one-liner guy. But this story is 12 years ago. He's just lost two men on his unit. It's the height of the global war on terrorism, and he's doing all these things. So I was like, well, I just can't make Zach the way that I make him in later books. We're going to have him younger, a little bit more dialed in, a little bit more serious about things. And these were the type of choices you have to make, because, you know, you think back 12 years in your own life and you know, things are a little bit different. And same thing with my hero. I wanted him to be sort of more cocky and brash and self-assured when he was 25 than he is when he's 37. So that was fun little balance to, you know, like you have these characters that everybody knows and you want to just tweak them, you know, just dial them in a slightly different direction because of the different timeline. So I actually did enjoy it. I always say I enjoy it once the book is done, but during the process of the book, I'm not a secure person when it comes to writing. I got a second guess and triple guess and quadruple guess. Huh.
Who do you show? Who's the first person besides yourself to read what you write?
It's my editor. It's always my editor, because, and I'd love to say that for some like reason, like I care about his opinion the most, which is actually true. But the reason he's the first one to read it is the book is due on a certain date. I've blown past that date and haven't turned it in. He's waiting for it. He's like snapping his fingers going, where is it? So the second I write the end, that is emailed to him. And then I'll fix everything that's wrong after that. But no, Tom Colgan, my editor, is the first to read anything that I've written.
That's really funny. And I did love those scenes, those earliest on scenes with the brash court as he joins the team. And he says, well, I'll take you all, you know, they're doing a paintball fighting exercise.
Yeah.
I'll take you all on. That was a great scene. Do you do any paintball yourself? That sounded, I didn't realize, like, of course it makes perfect sense that they would use like a paintball to,
I have done it, and it is a step above paintball. They're called simmunitions. And so they're real firearms that are designed to fire a paint cartridge. And it's still a plastic thing hitting you at about, I think, 900 feet a second or whatever. So I have like literal scars where I've done opposition force for a SWAT team. So a SWAT team raids a shoot house. They all have simmunitions, and I have a gun with simmunitions, and, you know, a string of SWAT guys come in, the lights are off, and they're playing like really loud, you know, speed metal through all the speakers to kind of like, you know, approximate, you know, the confusion. And you have these gunfights. And then I say that the bullets hurt so bad that literally I got shot in the knuckle one time and I saw stars. And it's like, how do you see stars when you've been shot in the finger? And they do hurt that bad. And But it's a lot of fun. I do as much research as I can on firearms and training and the tactics and battlefield medicine and all that sort of stuff. I think if you don't put too much in the story, I think it really adds to it. You can obviously go too far with it, but I like to do it.
You're a method writer. Did you jump out of any airplanes for this one?
Yes. So that's the one thing I don't do. I learned how to scuba dive. I took stunt driving courses, all sorts of firearm courses. I've been in the back of an F-18 flying around. I've done all these cool things, but like I have the opportunity to people that want to take me skydiving. And I'm like, nope, too scared. Can't do it. And it's like, I'm going to be a man and admit that I'm just really scared and I'm not going to come up with any other excuse. I would love to learn how to be a pilot, but jumping out of a plane seems like no thanks.
No, I agree with you there. I'm too smart. I'm going to keep both feet planted firmly in the ground. What's the one thing you would say? Was there any specific thing that you did in the name of research for the book that was the most fun or most enjoyable for you?
Well, for this book, you know, sadly, because of COVID, it's 2 years in a row. I haven't been able to do location research, and I love to do. I've been to 36, 38 countries doing research. And but for this one, I said it in Mumbai, India, which was a poor choice as far as like a place to get into. Tourist visas were not disallowed. And then I tried to get in on a business visa and then they disallowed that last spring you have a sort of a short window when you can do your location research. So I wasn't able to go, but I had a friend who's an acquaintance who's a writer in Mumbai. And she went and did location research for me, took pictures. She read a draft and, you know, fixed where I used some Hindi language and fixed other little things. Like, yeah, no, they don't let the rickshaws go south of this, you know, street at night. And, you know, it's like all these little things to make it realistic. But normally my favorite aspect is the location research. But for this one, I just, you know, I did some stuff with firearms like I do for most all the books. And that was basically the main part.
Speaking of rickshaws, there was a very exciting scene that I'm thinking of that seemed very visual with a bamboo pole and a rickshaw. That was incredibly exciting and very, I mean, the way you write it, it does read like a movie, like you're watching it. So just another reason I think this movie is going to be so good.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I kind of see when I write, I see things cinematically, or I like to, especially when you're writing these big set pieces, these big action sequences. And I was in Hong Kong a few years ago researching another book, and I saw they use bamboo scaffolding there, just like they do in India for construction of buildings. So I always had this in the back of my mind. Someday I need to do something with that. So I couldn't go to India this year. I used my knowledge of Hong Kong as a stand-in.
Nice. Do you have like a little file? Do you walk around? Do you use a notebook? Do you have like a folder on your on your iPhone? What do you do for those ideas?
Yeah. There's a note taking app called Evernote, and I just plug everything into that. And you know, if I'm trying to think of a title for my next book, I just go to my list of title ideas, you know, that have come up over the years. Or if I, you know, try and find, you know, literally just ideas for the book, I'll just start looking at stuff that I'd saved before, you know, like it'd be interesting if two guys in a hot tub, you know, were fighting with a tomahawk or something. That's not in any of my books, by the way. This is off the top.
Well, Mark, that's a different kind of book.
That's probably not a good example, but, you know, like just any random thing that pops into your head, I'll try and put it in there because I forget it if I don't write it down immediately.
Sure. And if you're anything like me, you go back and you look at these notes and you're like, what the hell is that? No idea.
Exactly. What's the context?
Well, I was talking about. Now we know that Court has tachypsychia, which he tells us is a neurological condition that alters the perception of time. Do you have something like this when you're writing? Do you get into a zone when you write? Do you sweat it out when you write? Does it come easy for you, or do you just have good days and bad days? How's it work for you, Mark?
It's good days and bad days, but yes, that feeling when you're in the zone and you look up and 3 hours have passed and you've written 2,000 words or whatever, it's like that's that beautiful high that as a writer you're always, you know, searching. You're always chasing that out. And so many times it's like you just look at the page and you're like, I got nothing. you know, both things happen. And as you get closer, every one of my books goes through sort of the same cycle where you have this really sort of low point in the middle where you're like, okay, I'm committed to this story and I'm confused by it. And I've got to like solve all my little problems. And I say you write a 160,000 word book, you know, that's 160,000 decisions you have to make. So at some point it gets a little overwhelming, but it always seems to come back around. TR6 is my 21st published novel and my 22nd will come out in July. So I'm, you know, I've found a way to get through it before. So when things get really muddled or tough, I just say like, yeah, you always work your way out of it. So hopefully you can do it one more time.
That's the great thing about experience. You know, you just rely on your past and you know you're going to get through it. Do you have any kind of writing idiosyncrasies or quirks or any superstitions that have to be in place when you write?
I always listen to white noise and it's always rain. Like I don't like a babbling brook or, you know, like any other sound. It has to be rain for some reason.
Really?
And I do that. I mean, it's really hard for me to write without some sort of noise going in my head. And I actually love writing at coffee shops because there's this sort of bustle around you, but you know, you can still stay focused. It's almost like if you're sitting in a coffee shop in some town, it's almost like having a fish tank or something, you know, just a kind of this like serene thing going on. But like locally, I can't really go to a coffee shop because people know who I am and they want me to write a book about them or they want me to write their book for them or something like that. It's gotten in the last few years to where I just write from my office, which is great too.
Yeah. What do you tell somebody who comes up and says, Mark, I got this great idea. I got this great idea for you. What do you say?
Yeah. I mean, I can open my email right now and I will have that message on there. It's every day. And what I always say, and I mean this like sincerely, it's like, just as you are very passionate about your idea, I have ideas about which I'm quite passionate. And, you know, I'm not, I wasn't just sitting here going like, God, I hope somebody walks up and tells me, you know, gives me an idea for my next book. And it's like, I'm contracted to write 6 books right now, you know, so my next 3 years are pretty dialed in. And I, gosh, everybody's like, man, if I could buy you a cup of coffee and tell you about, you know, my experience with my hairdresser or something like that. It's like, I think you'll love it. And you write this book. And then, you know, sadly people don't research you. And it, like they have a nonfiction story they want. And I'm like, I don't know the first thing about nonfiction. I don't know a nonfiction editor or, you know, I'm not the right guy. And so I always tell them when I became a writer, I didn't know any writers. I didn't know anybody that knew any writers as far as I know. It was just, all my focus was on my work, you know, like on writing a book and getting it good enough to get published. So I think any minute that somebody is like seeking out another author to chat them up about ideas or whatever is probably a minute they could have been working on their book and, you know, making it better.
That's a great way to put it. Did you always want to be a writer?
From age 22, and I got published at age 42. So, it took me 15 years, literally 15 years to write my first book. I started in 1990 and I finished it in 05 because I was piddling, you know, and I would, you know, have an idea and not write it down. And then once I finished that first book, I wrote the second book in 7 months. And Gray Man, which is my first published novel, was my fourth novel that I finished, but it was the first one that got published. So for 20 years, I wanted to be an author, but I was probably working at it for about 4 years before I actually became an author. If I started working hard in my early 20s, I probably would have gotten published a lot earlier. But, you know,
well, water under the bridge. We got to, you know, we got to live our lives, for goodness sake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
get it done. Right. Wow, that's really interesting. That's funny. So your first, so, I mean, could you even probably, you would never imagine the success you would have with this Gray Man series. Did you envision it as a series, or you're just trying to get published, really, probably when you wrote that?
Yeah, you're exactly, that's it, exactly. Like everybody, and I actually talked to Tom Clancy one time, and I was like, did you see where this series was going and everything from the beginning? And he absolutely did, and I believe him. I mean, like the way he was telling me how he had it mapped out.
Wow.
For me, I just wanted to hold a book in my hand, a little paperback book that had my name on it, some artwork and, you know, words in the middle were is important. And that was really as lofty as I was. And that's another piece of advice I give to people writing. There, a lot of people are like planning out their series. And I'm always like, don't worry about your series. If you write a good book, I promise you, your editor will make you do a series. They won't let you do anything else. You're home, you know, someone else will take care of that. Just put everything into that first book and, you know, where it's going to go. They might ask you down the road, but they will tell you that they want you to do a series. So yeah. Don't worry about that.
No, let's not put the cart before the dog.
Exactly.
The hell that that expression is. And it just seems to me it's just wasted energy. Pour your energy into the book that's in front of you instead of,
yeah,
you know, why are you thinking ahead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that'll work itself out. You just have to get past that first hurdle of having somebody say yes to publishing your book.
How did that happen? You teamed up with Tom Clancy. Did you enjoy that? Was that an experience for you that did you grow as an author working? Did he teach you a lot, or was that?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, it was, I'd only had 2 paperback books out, The Gray Man and the sequel On Target. I had written the third and just given it to my editor. And this was in 2011. And then I got asked, because I had the same editor that Clancy did, if I would be interested in co-authoring with Tom. And I just remember thinking like, oh my gosh, not Tom Clancy. Like, he's my favorite, but it was like, can we start at somebody, you know, that's had 3 books out or whatever, you know, like somebody like,
and we 25. Don't want to go to the top of the list.
Exactly. Why are we starting with Clancy? But I was also like, yeah, my agent would kick my ass if I said no to this, you know, it's like, it'd be the dumbest decision you can make. So yeah. it was really, really terrific. It was rewarding. I was proud to be involved with his last 3 novels before he died. And I was proud when his family asked me to continue the Jack Ryan series. So I ended up doing 7 in 6 years. And the last one I did was 5 years ago. And I look back at that time, like, did that really happen? It's like, wow, how did I do that? Because those were big books. I was writing other things. And, you know, so it was a very heady, you know, like fast paced time, but I'm so glad it happened. And it's really helped my own writing. I see my books after I started working with Clancy as very different as the books before, you know.
Margud is a writing machine. How do you do it? How do you crank out so many books and still keep the quality? This book, Sierra Six, so entertaining, so exciting. How do you, how many hours a day do you write?
It depends. The closer I get to deadline, the more freaked out I get. I mean, it's true. I will, the last couple of weeks before a book is due, I will just fly to Chicago or DC or Atlanta. I've done it many places and just hole up in a hotel, not even leave the hotel. Man. And write in the lobby all morning and then work out in the afternoon and then write in the room at night and eat in the lobby. And at that point, you know, I'm probably working 16 hour days if you add it all up. But, you know, early in the part, I'm just coming up with ideas and I'm writing a little bit here and there. But I just basically tell myself I can do two books a year and never to go back and do the same thing that I've done before. Like I will punt on a book before I start churning out something I've already done. And it gets tougher and tougher to come up with new things because sure. you picked off the fruit off the low part of the tree.
You got to open up that notepad and it's empty. You're like, what the hell? Yeah,
exactly. So what at that point you just have to go out and get new information and learn new things. And, you know, I get to fly with the US Navy and that'll work its way into a book. That's something I couldn't have done 10 years ago. It's always a progression, you know?
Cool. All right, Mark, time now for our segment we call Quick Six. Six quick questions, which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Oh, my gosh. God, there's so many. Drunk History. I've seen it all before, but my wife and I kind of bonded when we were dating over that show, and now we're watching them all again. So it's not a very cerebral answer, but that's the thing that we watched for like 3 hours last night. But I also like the show Succession. That's a really interesting show. Counterpart was a couple years ago, but it was a fantastic espionage series.
Cool. Very good. How about this, Mark? What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Fictional world or place would I like to visit? I don't know. Blade Runner is my favorite movie, although it's dystopian. It looks awful, but it's like my favorite. Yeah exactly. It looks really awful, but like that would be the coolest place to walk around. And I've been in like Hong Kong and Beijing, like at 3 o'clock in the morning, walking around because I have jet lag and it's raining and all the signs. And you're like, oh my gosh, I'm walking on the set of Blade Runner. It's fantastic.
Oh, cool.
But that's probably the last place I want to go, but it's the first thing that comes to mind.
But it last place you want to go, but first place you need to go. Let's say.
Yeah.
How about this? Mark, give us one of your top five favorite movies of all time. One of your.
Oh my gosh. Well, I just said Blade Runner. I think Man on Fire with Denzel Washington is one of my favorites.
Good one. Yeah,
Saving Private Ryan is a perfect film. Hunt for Red October is a perfect film. I'm not, this speed round isn't going so well because I'm giving you like five answers.
No, we like we call it a speed round, but we take our time. We want to get all of the answers. How about this? A top five favorite book that you've read?
Oh my goodness. I mean, there's so many fiction. It might be The Devil's Alternative by Frederick Forsyth, which came out, I think, in the 1980 or late 70s. It's just one of the best. Charm School by Nelson DeMille is probably one of my favorite books. Nonfiction. There's a book called Endgame about the Bosnian Civil War or the Srebrenica massacre that I've read multiple times because it's so well written and so interesting. So, yeah, I read a lot, as you can imagine. Cool.
That's right. How about this, Mark? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Oh gosh, I don't. I've dealt with a lot of social anxiety in my life. It's all gone away because of the just my profession now and sure, media and all this sort of stuff. But I went from like, you know, afraid to talk to anybody to now, you know, standing up in front of 500 people in Algeria and talking, you know, giving a speech. So that's all gone away. But singing in public, karaoke. I was in a band and I sang backup, but that was very different. That's a very different. Yeah, I was a drummer for a long time. I got a karaoke song. I can't think of anything that I just wouldn't cringe to do.
What was the name of the band?
Oh, okay. So we had a couple of names. We were called Heavy Weather, and we were called Bad English. And there ended up being another band called Bad English. This is the 80s, you know, it's like big hair, makeup, kind of metal type of stuff.
That's awesome. And finally, Mark, what book are you currently reading?
I am reading, there's two. Damascus Station. I'm still reading that. It's really good. And David McCloskey, I think is his first book. And another book that I've picked up is called Under Money. It so far is really, really good. It's about, you know, it's a spy novel about the financial underworld. So I'm reading those two books right now, slowly.
Very good. All right, Mark, listen, thank you so much for joining
me
in the little chat. Really appreciate it.
Thanks,
and love the book, Sierra 6. Really good. Really good.
I appreciate it.
Check
the gas.
Check the diesel fuel in your generator. You're doing all right out there.
Yeah. I was afraid the power is going to pop back on and it's going to look like the place blew up or something because all the lights are on.
That's true. Yeah. All right. Very good, Mark. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks so much.
You got it. Bye-bye. The Inside Flap. All right, there you go. Thank you so much to Mark Greeny. And check out that book. It is called Sierra 6. All right, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called Every Last Fear by Alex Finley. This is a thriller that came out last March. Mm. I read this book this past weekend. If you're looking for a book just to fly through, you got a free weekend or you got a winter weekend, whatever is going on, this is a really good one.
Great.
So, or if you have a lonely birthday weekend, like I am anticipating this coming weekend, might be good to grab something like this.
Sure.
So this is about a college kid named Matt Pine.
He won't be grabbing your husband who's going to be non-existent.
No. Now, speaking of Matt Pine, for some reason, I clearly pictured Chris Pine in my head.
Oh, sure.
A young Chris Pine for Matt Pine. So Matt goes to film school at NYU. One night, FBI agents, they come to his dorm. They tell him that his mom, his dad, his younger sister, and his little brother have been found dead in Tulum, Mexico.
Hmm. Oh, we've been to Tulum.
Yes. So, and Andrew has too. So they had gone down there for spring break. The Mexican authorities think it was a gas leak in the home that they had rented.
Oh.
Just a tragic accident.
Right.
However, the next thing Matt knows, he's being taken via helicopter to a maximum security prison to tell his older brother, Danny, the news that their family is dead. Oh. We find out that his older brother is in prison for life for the murder of his high school girlfriend. So Matt and his family are celebrities in a way, and this all starts to unfold in the story very rapidly. Hmm. They're celebrities in a way because of this documentary film that was done about Matt's older brother, Danny. In the film, it details why he's wrongly imprisoned. And in the book, a lot comes to light about how Danny was first taken in by the cops and interrogated without his parents or any representation in the room. So he was 18, still in high school, though, but he was technically an adult, and evidently it is legal. You don't have to call their parents at that age because they're an adult at that point.
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
So some of the scary stuff in this book is how easy it is to get a young person to admit to a crime that they didn't do. And if you don't come from a wealthy family, you know, that can afford a good lawyer, or you don't watch the CSI Law and Order type of shows, you know, you don't know, like, hey, you're entitled to this. You're in big trouble.
Mm. And so I remember a while back we had an author that we interviewed on the show. Remember, he talked about as well as there was a mentally handicapped guy, and it was very...
Oh, yeah, that was Victor Mithos talking about that.
Victor Mithos.
Yep, that's right.
But similar conversation, but, you know, his books were founded in fact.
Yes.
Right. That's right.
You know, but... You know, so this comes up.
That's true.
It does come up. Yeah. And when they talk about in this book, he talks about how easy it is and that like almost, a huge majority of the time, if you sit a teenager down and you say, hey, you know, we know you did it. It's okay. Just admit it. And then we'll let you go home. I know you're tired. We'll call your parents. We'll let them come and get you. if you just tell us how you did it.
Right.
And I'll tell you a personal story.
They're going to say that they did, is what it says, even if they didn't.
And so back in kindergarten, so we had some friends that went on vacation, and the cops were questioning me and my twin brother, kindergartners.
Weird.
And they were trying to get us to admit to...
So crazy.
This is weird.
You know, basically a house where people had taken like a moose off the wall, and as kindergartners, and my brother Anthony, he caved to the pressure and admitted that he did it.
Yeah.
But how is a kindergartner supposed to get like a mounted moose head off the wall?
A mounted moose head.
You know, but it was just like, you know, so this stuff happens. And I mean, it is, you know...
Typical Anthony.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The mounted moose head.
An overachiever even back then.
The thing is, though, it's something that you don't ever think about, but we should tell our kids, hey, listen, doesn't matter if you didn't do it. Don't talk to the police. Yeah. You know, make sure a family member is with you or you have a lawyer. That's you're entitled
first,
to
and
it.
That's the first thing Renata would tell us, too.
She Speaking would of, definitely of say that. Oh, our, yeah. Your, well, she's a public defender.
Representation.
And it doesn't matter. If you're innocent, it doesn't, like, either way, whatever. Even if you did it, don't tell them you did it.
Even if you did it. No, of course not.
Yeah. And maybe don't tell your lawyer that you did it either.
You didn't. Yeah. I don't think she would say never. I don't think they want to know. Don't tell anybody.
No. Yeah.
You can tell your priest. I think you can tell your, I think it's safe to tell your priest. Depends on your,
it depends on your religion. What you did.
Yeah, that is true.
So this story really gets going right from the beginning. It appears that the deaths of Matt's family in Tulum, those deaths might not be innocent. You know, there's a reason the FBI is involved. There's a reason they came to Matt at NYU. So the book flashes back to the night of the murder that got Danny sent to prison. It has police interview transcripts scattered throughout. It also flashes back to what led up to Matt's family's last-minute decision to go to Tulum. And it has each of the family members, the mom and the sister and the dad. And it's great because it just switches, you know, point of views with all these different people. It's not confusing, though. I will say that. You can, although if you're like me and you don't read chapter headings, do yourself a favor.
Oh, read the chapter headings.
So you know who's talking at that point. Yeah. I have a habit of just skipping over those. Yeah.
That's not a good habit to be
No. And it's also real time with Matt, who's on his way down to Mexico by himself to identify the bodies and have them released. So it's very exciting. This is a complex page-turning thriller. I especially like that I couldn't figure out where... Alex was taking the story.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Because during the whole thing, I'm like, I don't know where he's going with this. I don't know what's going on. And I like that because a lot of times
I love that. Yep.
I read so many different books, I can kind of tell I would imagine this is what's going to happen. So Alex Finley has a new thriller coming out this year. I'm very excited to read it. I'm on the wait list for it at the library. It's called The Night Shift. Sounds really good. So I'm just going to put that out there too.
I love that collection of short stories by Stephen King, Night Shift.
Is it The Night Manager? No, The Night Shift.
Yeah, it's called Night Shift. It was like his first collection of short stories with the Lawnmower Man in it.
Oh, yeah. It's been a long time.
Yep.
So it was good. It's called Every Last Fear.
Every Last Fear. All right. And that is recommended by...
Laura Medicus.
My book this week...
Dave Medicus.
...is also a page-turning thriller that I did not know where it was going. So if you're also want another thriller like that, that's a fast read and is really good... This is called Rubbernecker by Belinda Bauer. Now, this book had a lot going for it that I really enjoyed. First off, you got three different narrators, and each different narrator from each perspective was very unique and had something to offer. First of all, you get inside the mind of a guy in a coma ward. And if you want to be freaked out, this guy is aware of everything that's going on around him.
Whoa.
So like when they roll him over to face the window, he hates it because he can't see anything. But when they roll him over to the other side, he sees everything that goes on.
Is that true, though?
Who knows?
Because
who knows?
I read that other book.
I don't know. I mean, nobody
It depends
knows.
On...
You know, ask somebody who's in
things,
a coma.
I think. See?
And a lot of this in the book, they would come and there's like people would tap and tap their fingers. It sounds creepy because another point of view is a woman who's working in the coma ward.
Oh.
And these people, like there's violent twitching that goes on. Like these people gesticulate a lot. So picture a coma ward. You would think it'd be nice and peaceful.
Yeah,
and
that's what I'm picturing.
There's all kinds of things going on.
Really?
Like you'd walk in
like
and
spasms,
you start
like
talking.
Muscle spasms?
There are muscle spasms going on. They tap their fingers a lot. Like you talk to them, you see all kinds of stuff.
So if you ever spent significant time in a hospital... Mm-hmm. And if somebody's in a monitored room, right, which somebody in a coma patient, it has to be monitored, but it is anything but quiet. I mean, there's shift
That's
changes,
true.
There's buzzers
there's
going
always
off,
something
there's,
going
there's
on.
Alarms Beeping. Going off.
Yeah.
Constant.
But in this book, there's a lot going on in the
Good
patients
point.
Themselves, including this guy. And when I tell you he sees what's going on, he also sees a murder happen. And that's part of the mystery of this book.
That's a
so
good
that's
concept.
Very exciting. The woman who works in the morgue, or not the ward, the coma. There is a morgue in the book, but she works at the coma, on the coma ward. She does not like her job, and she spends most of her time flirting with the husbands who come to visit their wives who
that's
are in coma.
Creepy.
So that's creepy. And the third narrator, and the one whom you spend most of the time with, I absolutely love this guy. His name is Patrick. He has severe Asperger's, meaning he doesn't pick up on social or emotional cues, and he takes everything extremely literally. It's just fascinating to be inside his mind, and just a genius move on the author's part. It seems to me how well she does it describing how Patrick is feeling and why he responds to people the way that he does. You know, he's just, everything is taken, like he can't pick up on social cues, or he has no empathy. You know, so if you tell him a joke, he's going to take it extremely literally. It's really just a fascinating character. And she also uses it to for humor as well. So in this book, Patrick is taking an anatomy class because his father died when he was young, and he wants to find out really the secret to what happens when you die. So they're dissecting this cadaver piece by piece. And from there, I don't want to say too much about what happens, but it gets going. And like you said, Laura, in your book, you didn't know where that one was going to go. I had no idea at all where this was going to go and if things were going to tie together. And man, it is so good. It's just one of the most unique and original mystery thrillers I've read in a long time. They're short, quick chapters. They keep the action moving swiftly. There's plenty of humor to be found along the way, and the mystery will keep you guessing all the way to the very end. This is offbeat, engaging, weird, strange, and above all, enthralling. I love the way the author Belinda Bauer does brilliant things with timelines that surprise you. Love this one. Cannot recommend it highly enough. It is called Rubbernecker by Belinda Bauer. And good luck putting it down once you start, because, man, you just got to find out what happens. And it just, that main character, Patrick, I really enjoyed getting inside his mind and being in there for a while. Really, really good stuff. All right. So that's my book this week.
Dave Medicus.
Andrew. What do you got?
So this week I've got another book. It's another debut novel.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did a debut novel last week. And this book is titled The Last Sun, S-U-N. And the title of the book is not what you think.
Mm.
And so it is a svelte 300...
How do you know what I was thinking?
Well, okay, what does The Last Sun mean?
Actually, as soon as you said Last Sun, I was thinking S-O-N. So you're right. It's not what I was thinking.
I was too.
But when you say The Last Sun, I would imagine it's like an apocalyptic book.
No. Oh. Nope.
You're right.
Buzzer.
It's not what I was thinking.
That's right. Laura, do you want to take a guess what The Last Sun.
The Last Sun in the solar system?
No. So.
Andrew just points.
This is an inventive novel. and the author is K.D. Edwards. And... You know, and this book is very creative. It's another book where you really don't know where this book is going.
Aha, we got three of them for you this week.
And this book is, I guess I would call it fantasy, but this book is a mixture of magic, it is a mixture of technology, And this book also refers to Atlantis and Atlanteans, right? So it's sort of like another take on, right, Atlantis. And it takes place, you know, kind of, it could be present day, like the technology is like our level of technology. But of course, there's the mystery of magic. There's the mystery of Atlantis, which is blended into this book. And the book is fairly complex. There's a lot going on in this book. But the book follows the character Rune St. John. And this book is like, there's all these noble houses, right? Mm-hmm. And the noble houses has lords and everything. And so Rune, his entire house was massacred. And so he is the only surviving... he's the only surviving person of the fallen Sun Court. So when the book refers to the last Sun, you know, he is the scion of the Sun Court, and so he is the last Sun, right? But he's also the last Sun, you know, as well, right? So, but really a very clever title.
So I was right.
In terms of the book, yeah. And you kind of wonder, because he has some powers, and he's really very powerful. And he's also, there's a prophecy that it was revealed to him as well, and he's part of a prophecy. But, you know, it's there's only a few books I've read where they take magic and technology, and they kind of try and blend it all together. And so he pulls it off nicely. And, you know, and so Rune's entire family was massacred. He's making the best of the situation that he can. And he basically is sort of like I don't know that you call him a mercenary for hire, but, you know, he will get hired to do odd jobs. And in this case, this book is, is Lady Justice. Her son has gone missing, and her son is a very smart, good-looking young man, very successful, and sometimes he just disappears and then he comes back, and everybody thinks, oh, you know, he's just gone on another jaunt. But that is not the case here. And so he's been hired to basically track him down. And of course, as he starts trying to figure out the truth, he keeps getting attacked. Right? And these attacks are bizarre. And halfway through the book, I figure, oh, I'm starting to understand this pretty complex world. But then the mystery of what happened to Lady Justice's son, and his, you know, his name is Adam, but you don't pronounce it Adam. You pronounce it like the old Atlantean way, which is Adem.
Yeah. You know the Atlantean.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But just stranger things start happening. So just when you think you understand it, things start happening that even the characters in this book are scratching their heads like, how is that even possible? So Rune St. John is a very compelling character. He's a very likable young man, very capable, very likable. He actually ends up taking in a sort of an orphan of sorts, and he ends up sort of taking him under his wing as part of the book. And the orphan has been mistreated for most of his life, and so Rune is one of the first people to treat him decently, right? And that's also a bit of discovery as well. Like, you don't know much about the orphan. And, you know, and that's also part of the mystery. And then, of course, as all this is going on, of course, Rune stumbles onto a seer who gives him glimpses. He's like, here, take this, take that. You're going to need it. And he starts, you know, uttering this stuff, which seems like it's nonsense, but it's things that the seer has seen, which are going to make a difference in terms of the different futures that he sees. And this is the first book. It's indicated that there's going to be a second book in the series. But it really is. It's a very refreshing, very fascinating book. You really don't know where this book is going. And the book is The Last Sun by K.D. Edwards.
All right. And that's recommended by
Andrew Dowd.
Which means it's time for the audio book of the week. And my pick this week is called Hurricane Season. Now, this is an interesting book in that I listened to this book and I did not realize it at the time as I was listening to it. But apparently, this is not a YA book. This is a middle grade book. So, Like the whole time, this is a sweet story about this young sixth grade girl I was really, you know, empathizing with and feeling for. It's a middle grade book. I had no idea. I mean, I don't read YA. I certainly don't read middle grade book, but books. But that's
middle grade book.
Middle grade book. But that's what this one is. But I got to tell you,
that's a good recommendation for it.
Grown man, I enjoyed it immensely. So kudos to the author.
Did you cry, Dave? Were you in tears?
I did in this book. So God only knows how much the kids would respond to this. Or maybe they wouldn't cry. Anyway, you know, it's just one of those books I got into, and I wasn't thinking about the genre or anything. I just was relating to the characters.
I mean, sometimes with YA in particular, it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter, you know.
And it does not matter. Yeah. We're just out here, a couple
middle
of schmucks.
Middle grade, maybe.
Looking
what?
For some
no,
good
I'm
stories.
No, I'm just kidding. No.
How would you know? I don't know. Anyway, I guess my tip off would be that the main character is a girl named Fig, who is a sixth grader. So I guess there could have been a little.
No, but I've read but adult books with kids.
Plenty of
and
yeah, adult books with who are younger.
Catcher in the Rye, maybe.
Sure. Well, he's a little older than a sixth grade. Anyway, so Fig is really struggling with some serious issues going on at home with her dad. You see, her mother left when she was very, very young. And ever since then, her dad, who was like a big name composer and musician, a guy who played at Carnegie Hall, he has seen his mental health deteriorate to the point that social services have come to the house recently to do checkups on them. And Fig is very, very concerned and worried that they're going to take her away from her dad. In fact, several times he has shown up at her school, like disoriented, looking for her, hair all crazy, and really just kind of out of his mind. And it's embarrassing for her. She's getting kind of picked on by other kids because of this as well. And it's just heartbreaking to read about a sixth grader who really has to be the adult in the house. She's at some point, she has to make sure that there's food to eat. She has to make sure that the bills are getting paid because her dad is that kind of bipolar, really, is what he's dealing with. Until a new neighbor moves in, Mark, who strikes up a friendship with her father that gradually deepens. It's just really a sweet book that tugs at the heartstrings as you pull for Fig, whose feelings of loneliness and despair are kind of heartbreaking, but ultimately heartwarming. So if you're looking for something to stir up those long, dormant, and dead feelings inside, check this one out. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Hurricane Season.
Good morning, little mamas, she murmured as she pulled out 8 brown eggs, lightly speckled. 2 yellow, and 1 as blue as a robin's egg. Worked hard this morning, didn't you? She placed the eggs in the basket hanging by the door, then scattered a few scoops of feed across the ground. The hens fluttered down from their perches to dine, all indignities forgiven. With the hen house door locked tight behind her, she paused before turning back to the house. It often stopped her, the beauty, almost perfection, of their little space on this earth. Franklin Dairy Farm, the land Ty had worked and shaped and brought to life. The sky was now streaked with bold purples and blues, bright pinks and yellows. Oaks and hickories, tall, thick, and majestic, dotted their 500 acres. She could hear the steady whoosh, whoosh of the milking machines, even out here in the yard. Faint strains of Chris Stapleton's Tennessee whiskey floated out of the speakers. Ty and Walker had jiggered up in the nooks and crannies of the barn.
All right, there you go. That is your
audiobook
of the week.
So, you know, nice little jab, Dave, but you know, I am a warm and caring person.
Sure you are.
Goodness gracious.
Shouting at your boys about Valentine's Day.
It's a fake holiday. Manufactured holiday.
It is a little ridiculous.
It is.
Yeah.
All right, I'll tell you what is not ridiculous. Our show. How about that? Thank you for listening. That was episode 157. And thanks to Mark Greeny. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next week.
Adios.
Excelsior.
Here.
Here's my Venmo. You can send it right to me.